90.7 FM, Ekwa, New York.
Oui. Tout le monde qui t'a écouté nous, bonsoir, Nali, nous allons tourner l'autre dimanche à même l'heure.
Has prohibited pirate operators, that is people who operate without licenses, from ever owning a low power station. On the other hand, that same pirate could own, for example, WCBS-TV in New York City.
Hi, it's Shannon, Emily,
and Hannah, and you're listening to 90.7 FM
WGXC
Acra.
The Catskill Town Board meets every first Tuesday of the month at 6:30 p.m. at the Catskill Town Hall and holds a committee meeting the third Wednesday of the month at 6:30 p.m. You can turn out in person at the Catskill Town Hall to speak at these meetings or tune in to a live web stream through the Catskill Town Board and WGXC. Go to wgxc.org/listen or click on the listen button at wgxc.org to tune in to any of the Catskill Town Board meetings, the first Tuesday of the month at 6:30 p.m. and the third Wednesday of the month at 6:30 p.m. at wgxc.org and townofcatskillny.gov.
WGXC underwriting support is provided in part by Sun Common, supporting vibrant communities across New York for over 15 years, offering custom solar installations for homes, farms, and businesses. Information at suncommon.com.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Galen, Tom, and Echo of Acre, New York. WGXC's sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. Become a WGXC sustaining supporter today. Go to wgxc.org and click donate. Thank you for your support.
Take your Wellingtons off, children, and Mammy will tell you a pleasant story.
Good evening. This is Kevin Factor, and this is Forging Ahead. And I have with me in the studio today my favorite co-pilot, Ben Hale, author, the Google before Google, professor, and... just a font of wisdom and wit. Welcome back, Ben.
Thank you very much for having me. It's always a blast to be on Forging Ahead.
So it's spring.
It is.
It's spring.
Yes.
And
a few days ago.
And last year, I don't know if you recall, around this time, I had my another co-pilot, Eric Fixler, on, and we did a whole Passover thing, right? And I feel like the Christians sort of got short shrift, right?
Right. Well, I mean, Christianity is closely connected to Judaism.
Yeah.
Of course.
Yeah, no, they are part of the Judeo-Christian...
Right, the Abrahamic religions.
The Abrahamic religions, yeah.
Right.
So I thought we'd do a little Easter,
sure.
You know. But not just Easter, also spring. This is a time of birth and rebirth, mm-hmm. And
is it Easter next weekend?
I don't know. I don't really pay attention.
Okay.
I know it's the first full moon.
Has Passover
after,
happened?
No. Passover's yet. We're yet to Passover.
Okay.
But the first full moon after the equinox.
Oh, okay.
Right. I believe.
Okay.
Which is kind of an interesting way of.
Of
doing it.
Of organizing your
Organizing calendar.
Yeah.
Well,
it's a very ancient thing.
It is an extremely ancient thing. And it not only... I always like the story behind the calendar that we have. Often the young people, if they have questions for me...
the young people? I thought you were going to say... they don't remember the days of the, you know...
The Julian calendar.
The Julian calendar.
The Julian
exactly.
calendar. When
like,
I was
like
your
those,
age...
Those whippersnappers who were born after 1751.
Well, the reason they had to redo the calendar was because Easter was, like, drifting into midsummer.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, I thought it was because... I was reading about this recently, that Britain used the Julian calendar way later than any other major European country.
No, it was, I think it was Russia.
Russia was the last holdout?
I believe, I don't know, yeah, I think because, and that's why the October Revolution was in November.
Right, because they were still on the Julian calendar.
Yeah.
Well, Britain switched.
And then just Russians, yeah. You just can't get a straight answer out of them.
Yeah, Britain switched in 1751. And most of Europe had been using the Gregorian calendar since the Renaissance, but they were like the last major holdouts, and it was kind of funny. They there's a William Hogarth cartoon about this. There's a William Hogarth cartoon about this, about people protesting, switching to the Gregorian calendar, which they did. It was kind of like. You know, the sort of...
the daylight savings time of its
yeah,
day.
Yeah, yeah, it was like the country yahoos of the day were protesting it because it was like a tradition, you know, and there's a William Hogarth cartoon about it that the caption is something like, give us our 11 days, because when they switched, they lost 11 days. They had to jump from, like, September 1st to September 12th.
Huh.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Right.
Well, yeah, yeah. Well, but the main the impetus behind it was essentially Easter was just getting out of whack,
right?
With spring.
Uh-huh.
So, so we're gonna. I got some music, some songs of spring.
Right.
Some songs that overtly deal with mm-hmm. our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ,
right.
Who is risen
right.
on that day. interesting little side note. As I was sort of doing a little research on this, I noticed because like everybody's got their different traditions for Easter. You know, the fact that we have an Easter rabbit and Easter yeah. eggs.
Easter bunny, like that's a weird one. Do you know where that came
that's
from?
That's German. Like okay. All the weird, fun, sort of secularized
holiday things
to do are German.
Usually come from the Christmas tree, German.
Christmas tree.
And the Easter bunny is German somehow?
The Easter bunny is German. Because mm-hmm. when I lived in Ireland mm-hmm. and I ran a small hotel out there,
uh-huh.
I organized an Easter egg hunt.
And people had never heard of it.
They had never done an Easter egg. They'd seen it. They were aware of it. It was like one of these weird American traditions
right.
to them.
Mm-hmm.
They had very different traditions for Easter. And so I had a big Easter egg hunt, and like nobody knew what to do.
Well, I mean, it's pretty
like,
easy to tell
it was like,
them.
Well,
right?
I mean, just like so you hit a bunch of eggs, and why do we want to go look for them? You know, just like well, some of them made are chocolate. Like
well,
that makes no sense.
I mean, you know, it's children who are doing it, right?
Yeah, I probably should have started with the children. I had
because it's also really strange. When you're a child, you know, like I remember, you know, like at least in
well,
in
everything is strange when you're a child.
Yeah,
that's sort of the fun of being a child.
Because like the thing is that you know we would at least when I was a kid at Easter we would dye the eggs that first because that was kind of a fun activity,
mm-hmm.
right? And then. You know, our parents would go and hide them and then tell us that the Easter Bunny had just hidden the eggs that we had just dyed. And it was, you
well,
know.
I mean, the Easter Bunny, I mean, that's how I learned about outsourcing. You know, I mean, basically it was just like the brand, right?
Right. So like, you like, just, like how Easter stupid do you think I am?
The Easter Bunny was just slapping his brand on your labor, you know.
Exactly.
It's a good lesson for children on the economics and the relationship between labor and capital.
Right.
I mean, that's what we did in my house.
Well, I remember believing in Santa Claus, but I never at any point recall a time when I believed in the Easter Bunny because I knew that it was like...
It was
know.
It was just beyond.
Yeah. Well I mean, because like when I was a kid, I remember you know going to our grandparents' house, and they had a chimney, a fireplace with a chimney. Whereas at our grandparents' house, they were old people who didn't want to deal with that, so they had a glassed-in like gas fireplace.
Right.
And you know that we hung stockings on that fireplace, but obviously there was like a glass window there. And
right.
as a kid, I was like. How's this going to work? Like, how is Santa going to
get
through this?
Well, I think, like, again, I think all of those valuable fictions are
Right.
If kids are really paying attention, yeah, the lesson, the takeaway of like Santa Claus, the Tooth Fairy, the Easter Bunny is trust no one.
Yeah.
like you cannot, like, yeah. Yeah. Not only will your friends lie to you, your parents will lie to you, society will conspire.
Yeah. The internal logic of Santa Claus made enough sense to me that I was concerned that he wouldn't be able to get through the glass. But I never had any moment like that with the Easter Bunny. It was nonsense from the very beginning.
That's sort of the nature of faith, though, isn't it, Ben? I do remember once when my father was somewhat of a fabulist, I remember I was starting to doubt the existence of the Easter Bunny.
Right.
Know? And it's like one of these things, it's like you want to believe in magic, right?
Yeah.
And gradually you realize that the only magic in the world is the love, you know.
Well, I mean, but was Easter connected? Okay, go ahead.
So my father could tell that my faith and belief in this fiction, which he didn't believe in. He was Jewish. He was just like, he thought it was hilarious.
Right.
So he says, I was like, oh, there's not really an Easter Bunny. And my dad says, well, you know, I actually kind of thought that. And I didn't really believe it, you know. But last night I was up in my study and I heard this noise. And I went in and I just sort of peeked out of the study and there was this green glow. And it was sort of moving around the floor, and it went up the stairs, and every stair it stopped at, it left a little chocolate egg, and I couldn't explain it, and it just, and I was like, what? Oh my God. So it's not like an Easter Bunny, it's like some Easter phantasm, right?
Right, or some sort of alien force or something.
And so he completely spun it, and I believed it until very recently.
It turns out there's no Easter Bunny. The Easter Bunny is actually just a bodiless green glow.
Yeah, that's what I believe. Like until I was in my you know early teens, I guess.
Right.
I like, but so funny. As I was the eggs, Easter eggs.
Right.
I believe that the custom of dyeing Easter eggs comes from the Greek Church, the Greek Orthodox Church.
Right.
And
I've also heard that
Easter itself is an English word. It's an old Anglo-Saxon word, and there's an old Anglo-Saxon goddess that was associated with the springtime,
right?
And mentioned in the Venerable Bede's Histories of the Anglo-Saxons, and because he was venerable,
right?
Like people interpreted a lot of things from his writing, and so Oster or Eoster then became Easter, and it's only in English, it's not in any of the Romance languages. In Romance languages and in Greek, it's similar to Pascha.
Right.
Which is literally translated Passover.
Right.
Which is like, oh, that's kind of interesting. They maintain that connection.
Right.
And in the Greek Orthodox Church, you dye the Easter eggs red. Like that color. No other
color. Only that color.
Only, yeah. I think it took America to sort of break out of that, you know. But the reason is it's sort of, you know, it's Christ, the blood of Christ sacrificed for you.
Right.
And then the part of the ritual is the cracking of the egg.
Right.
Right. The cracking of the egg is not, is the cracking of the tomb of Jesus to release Jesus.
And the egg is Jesus.
The egg is Jesus.
Right.
Yeah.
Because
symbolically.
Right. You told me yesterday this is supposedly because Mary Magdalene brought eggs to the tomb watch party.
Yeah, yeah. It was her turn. Yeah, Mary Magdalene, because they took turns, you know, because they didn't know how long this was going to take.
Right.
And so it was Mary Magdalene's turn, and she brought eggs, and they turned red when the time had come.
When the tomb, when the
stones. No, when he died on the cross for our sins.
Oh, wait, so she was eating eggs at the crucifixion?
Oh, no. You're right. There was the watch party at the tomb.
Right, yeah. Like all the disciples were gathered
around.
Yeah,
and then they fell asleep.
Right.
But there's a lot...
Because, like, in all the synoptic gospels, nobody actually sees him walk out of the tomb, right? They just see the stone rolled back?
They saw the stone rolled back, yeah. And right. And for those of you who are not familiar with the Synoptic Gospels are the right. first three
Gospels. Matthew, Mark, Luke, and Luke.
Matthew, Mark, and Luke. John is sort of like...
John's the weird one.
He is the weird one, yeah.
Well, John was the one that was probably written about 300 years later.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. He did a lot of backfilling.
Yeah. It's also the most beautifully written of them, John.
Well, he had time. He had the extra time.
Right.
He was sort of like the special ed apostle.
No, like all the interesting poetry in the New Testament is in the Gospels, John. Like in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. It's good. It's beautiful writing.
That's good. Yeah. I think that's gonna endure.
Right, yeah. No, people will like that one.
People will like that. So, so we got spring, and I'm so excited. Today's really the first day of spring, feels like to me. It's a gorgeous day.
Yeah, it was very warm today.
So I have some songs for spring and some poetry, too. And so let's get into our first song.
Great.
And it's a familiar song, and it's a song that most people don't go, oh, it's a spring song, but you know what? It is a spring song, and it's not done by who you think it's going to be done by. So, here we go.
It's all right. No, no, no.
Next up, Gerard Manley Hopkins.
By Gerard Manley Hopkins. Nothing is so beautiful as spring, when weeds in wheels shoot long and lovely and lush. Thrush's eggs look little low heavens, and thrush through the echoing timber does so rinse and ring the ear, it strikes like lightnings to hear him sing. The glassy pear tree leaves and blooms, they brush the descending blue. That blue is all in a rush with richness. The racing lambs, too, have fair their fling. What is all this juice and all this joy? A strain of the earth's sweet being in the beginning, in Eden Garden. Have, get before it cloy, before it cloud Christ Lord, and sour with sinning, innocent mind, and mayday in girl and boy. Most, O maid's child, thy choice, and worthy the winning.
I recently saw his grave, John Manley Hopkins.
John Manley Hopkins. I believe Richie Havens is still alive. That was Richie Havens.
Well, Richie Havens, yeah.
Richie Havens covering the Beatles,
right.
Here Comes the Sun. But yeah. Gerard Manley Hopkins, where was it?
In Glasnevin Cemetery in Dublin.
Oh.
Yeah.
He wasn't Irish, was he?
No, but he lived there for most of his life.
Yeah? On holiday?
No, he was a monk.
Oh.
Yeah, he was a Catholic monk who was originally from Britain, but he...
is a little hostile for them.
Right. He went to Ireland in part to be with his fellow Catholics.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
What a great poem.
Yeah, it was an amazing poem.
All this juice.
Right. Juice and joy.
Juice and joy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And a fun fact about Here Comes the Sun is that I believe... it's one of the very few Beatles songs that was entirely written by George Harrison.
I think he wrote a lot.
Yeah, but I mean, usually it was Lennon and McCartney,
yeah.
and that he would add a few things. But there were a few songs that he wrote all by himself.
Yeah,
I think that's one of them.
Yeah, I know for a fact that he did that. But if you watch the Get Back, you'll see.
Uh-huh. I've heard it's good. I haven't seen it.
Oh my God, you got to watch it.
Yeah,
you got to watch it. It'll give you. A rebirth in your love of the Beatles and the creative process too. You
right,
know, it was really wild. But
yeah.
You see, like George Harrison's bringing these songs, and they're like, later, George, whatever.
Right.
And they're like, oh, that's that amazing song from his solo album. Oh, that's another amazing song.
Right,
from
yeah.
his solo album.
It's like, I've heard that George Harrison was really into changing time signatures. In songs like that's frequently in Beatles songs, like the only thing they let him add to the song is like, let's change this time signature for three bars and then go back to the 4/4.
Oh, I don't know. I don't know. This is we're here to usher in spring.
To usher in spring.
Yeah,
not talk about the Beatles. All right.
So I got a. You got anything to say about Gerard Manley Hopkins?
Well, I mean, I love Gerard Manley Hopkins. He's a really interesting poet. He was a total weirdo who, I believe, did not publish very much poetry in his lifetime.
Mm.
He was a monk. I think he was a Benedictine monk.
Mm. When was he writing in the
1700s? 19th century? Yeah.
Oh, in the 19th century.
In the 19th century, and like I think he might have died maybe in the very early 20th century or something like that.
So relatively recent.
Yeah, as far as poets go. Yeah, no, he's a spring chicken.
Ooh, there we go.
Yeah.
Cool. So I got another song that I believe. Probably in the history of the world has never followed a Gerard Manley Hopkins poem.
Well, let's make history.
All right.
A little bird, he told me so. He said, come on, get on the go. Open your eyes, the sky is full of butterflies. The blossoms on the trees stirred up the honeybees. Spring makes my fever rise. Spring fever, spring is here at last. Spring fever, my heart's beating fast. There is no doubt now, love is in the air. Get up, spring is everywhere.
But if you feel the wanderlust, just grab a car, a hop a bus. In every town, there's excitement to be found. So much is happening, don't miss the joy of spring. The world's in love, just look around. Spring fever comes to everyone. Spring fever, it's time for fun. Spring fever time, spring fever, watch that fever climb. There is no doubt now, love is in the air. Get up, spring's everywhere. Spring's everywhere.
Mercifully short song by Elvis.
Yeah.
From one of his, one of his movies.
Right.
I think it was called "Oh Girl Happy," which, have you seen that?
I have not. No.
I think occasionally they'll show them in sort of indie houses.
Yeah.
When they're doing revivals of Elvis's best films.
I have seen exactly two Elvis movies.
That's two more than me.
Yeah, Jailhouse Rock and Blue Hawaii.
Which did you prefer?
Jailhouse Rock.
Really?
Yeah.
Because the sexual tension.
Well, it's kind of a funny thing about that song is that that song was written by I'm blanking on the name of the songwriting team, but it was a songwriting team that wrote a lot of songs for Elvis, and they also wrote a lot of songs for the Coasters.
Huh.
The
Yakety Yak, Don't Talk Back.
Exactly. Yeah. And they kind of specialized in funny novelty songs.
Oh,
that's what they did for the Coasters.
Oh, and man,
that Jailhouse Rock was written for the Coasters. Because it was obviously a gay joke. It's like prison is not a co-ed environment. It's like number 47 said, number 3, you're the cutest jailbird I ever did see.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, yeah, that's the joke. It's supposed to be silly. But Elvis, you know, like at some point he got a hold of the song and he liked it so much that he wanted to do it. And they were like, well, this was a silly song that we intended for the Coasters. And he was like, no, I want to do it like straight up, like serious. And they said, all right. And that's the story behind the song.
Uh-huh. What's the story of Jailhouse Rock, though?
That's the story. Those guys wrote it for the Coasters.
No, but I mean like the movie.
Oh, I can't remember. Like the best things about it are the musical dance numbers.
Oh.
I mean, it's set in a prison. I don't remember. I saw it when I was a kid. I don't remember the specifics.
Wow.
It's in black and white. Blue Hawaii is in color.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, you can't really call something blue anything and have it in color. So Ben, what have you been working on?
I've been working on the last few months. I've been working on a piece for Harper's, and it's in the middle of being edited right now, and I don't know when it's going to come out yet.
Ooh.
But that's what I've been working on, and then I've been working on trying to turn it into a book, and I'm working on a book proposal about it right now.
Wow. Wow, that sounds wonderful. Is it a nonfiction story about your family?
Yeah, I mean it involves my family. Oh. Yeah, definitely. You know, you want to hear the story?
You give us a little teaser. You mind?
Okay, I'll give you a teaser. And then I remembered since talking to you about it that I have told several people involved with it that I wouldn't use their names, their real names, and I haven't thought of pseudonyms for them yet. So I'll have to be careful about not naming them as I tell the story.
That sounds good.
This really interesting thing happened about 22 years ago, where my father's older brother and his wife, my uncle and aunt, they were hiking in the woods in Newton County, Arkansas, which is a very rural county in the highest elevations of the Ozarks, really middle of nowhere. There's very few people living there.
Mm.
It's the boonies. It's a protected wilderness area. It has been since 1972.
And they were hiking on a trail there with a few friends of theirs and their 6-year-old granddaughter Haley, my second cousin, and they were going to go on this short hike in the morning at Hawksbill Crag Trailhead, which is a trail that very short trail there. It's only a mile long. They were going to hike that trail in the morning, and then they were staying at a cabin owned by a friend of theirs on the mountain. And they were going to go back to the cabin, eat lunch, and then meet up with a larger group for an organized group hike to see the wildflowers that were then in bloom, because this was the height of the spring. This was in it happened on April 29th, 2001. It was the height of, it was like pollen everywhere. It was the height of the springtime bloom. The main attraction of the day was going to be the wildflowers. And they went on this hike, and basically, Haley got mad about something. She was being about as difficult as a 6-year-old girl can be that day, and she was mad, and she sat down in the middle of the trail, sat down on top of a rock, on top of a waterfall, and time was beginning to tick. And if they wanted to make it back to the cabin, have time to fix lunch and eat it and still get to the larger group hike to see the wildflowers at 1 o'clock. This was about 11:45. They were going to have to head back and kind of hurry up a little bit because there was starting to be a time crunch. And Haley sat down on the rock, refused to move, and my Aunt Joyce told everyone else, all right, you go on ahead back to the cabin and fix lunch, and I'll stay behind and deal with the kid problem. Mm-hmm. And she and another friend of her and Jay's, a guy named Clay Bass, who's since died after this happened, has happened in the last 20 years, he stayed behind, and they tried to get Haley to move. She wouldn't move, and they tried and tried and tried. Nothing would work. She wouldn't budge. And eventually they tried the kind of nuclear option of trying to get a kid to do something she doesn't want to do, which is to say, I don't know what you're doing, but, you know, I'm moving on. Play upon the fear of abandonment. That usually works pretty quick.
Mm-hmm.
And they walked, you know, stomped away out of sight around the bend in the trail. And the thing about this trick is that it's got to work the first time. And you have to wait kind of a while, because if you go back too soon, she'll know you're bluffing and it won't work. And so, like, they hiked around just out of sight.
Again, another useful fiction.
Yeah.
Children. Right.
But waited and waited and waited. And then eventually she dragging her heels, pouting, eyes downcast, just, you know, mood spoiled for the rest of the day, eventually showed herself on the trail. And then they hiked up around the bend a little bit more, and then she came, and then they hiked a little bit more and waited and waited and waited, and she didn't come. And then Joyce said to Clay, just go on ahead and join the others. I'm gonna have to go down there and drag her back by a rope or something. And she went back down the trail, and Haley was gone. And
gone.
She ran back down to the waterfall to see if she went that way,
right.
And she wasn't there. And then she ran back up and saw that there was a fork in the trail. And that's when she started to panic, because they had been coming to the trail the back way from their friend's cabin, not the way most people come to it from the trailhead on the public road.
Thought that she maybe had gone down that way.
Yeah, that fork leads up to the trailhead where the trail starts. And so she thought she must have accidentally gone the wrong way. And so she started going that way up the other trail and met a couple of hikers eventually who were coming down from the trailhead. And those two hikers had not seen a little girl on the trail. And so
not then, that way.
Yeah, she didn't come that way. And so she ran back and eventually found Clay and told her that Haley was missing. And eventually everybody else was spread up and down the trail calling her name. And eventually there was a landline in the cabin, and they called 911 from the cabin. And eventually it became the largest search and rescue operation in Arkansas history.
Wow.
She was gone for two nights and 3 days.
What?
Yeah. And,
oh my God, they must have been absolutely gutted.
They were, yeah. And by the end of that,
two nights and 3 days.
Yeah.
Wow.
So by the time night fell, that all happened around noon, and by nightfall, there were sheriffs and park rangers and police from several different jurisdictions, and they had a couple of helicopters, whacking around the valley looking for her. And they didn't find her all night. They didn't find her all day the next day either, or the next night. And the thing is that especially by the second day, there were just hundreds of people in the woods looking for her. You know, friends and family and local people who lived in the area who didn't know my family but just heard the news and volunteered to help look. Lots and lots of cops. They had four helicopters by then. And on that second day, they had been using search dogs to try to find her, and they pressed some of her clothing to the dogs' snouts, and several different times, starting in different areas of the woods, the dogs picked up the scent and then followed it up to the dirt road where the trailhead is and lost it. Mm. They kept losing it at the road, and then by the third day. These cops were basically like, she's not here, and they were beginning to think that the reason she wasn't there is because they hadn't found her is because she wasn't there, that someone had taken her.
Oh.
That's why they lost the scent of the road.
Oh, and God, terrible.
Yeah, and
oh
at that point, Haley's parents, Steve and Kelly, Kelly is Jay and Joyce's daughter. They did a press conference because they were convinced that somebody had taken her at that point, where they like pleaded to have someone to return her. But later that day, in about mid afternoon, there were a couple of guys who were local residents who were hunters, experienced hunters who knew this wilderness really well. They were riding mules, and they found her. She was sitting on a rock beside the Buffalo River, about 1,000 feet below and 4 miles away from the main search area where everyone had been looking for the last 3 days.
Mm.
They were not an official part of the search party or any a search effort or anything.
The two guys are hunting, and they came upon a little girl.
No, they were looking for her.
Oh, but they were just she was just sitting on a rock.
She was sitting on a rock by the river, and. And they took her back by mule all the way back to the main search area where everybody else was. It took them 3 hours to get there, and when they brought her back, they took her to the nearest hospital where they treated her for dehydration. She was pretty badly dehydrated, but other than that, she was okay. She was pretty much fine. They released her the next morning. Obviously, everyone was extremely relieved.
Oh my God! I can't believe it.
And then when they took her home, there was a kind of familiar TV cliche scene on their front lawn of all the newspaper reporters and the cameramen and the news vans with the satellite dishes on top, clamoring for interviews. And they did some interviews with the local news and so on. But basically, her parents were like, this is a really strange thing, after Haley did this thing that she definitely should not have done, ran away from the adults in the middle of the woods, and then that it was followed by this terrifying and physically harrowing experience of being lost in the woods for 3 days, and then right after that, she's, made to feel like a rock star because there are all of these, media wanting her interview.
Right, right.
They're like, this is, insane emotional whiplash for a six-year-old girl.
Oh, anybody.
Yeah, anybody, but, sure. They were worried about the psychological effects of this of all the craziness.
As you would, yeah.
Right, and so they took her away for a few days. They went on an impromptu vacation. They asked her what she wanted to see, and her favorite thing that she'd ever seen at that point in her life was the Gateway Arch in St. Louis, and so they went on a very quick vacation to St. Louis to take her to see the arch. And on the drive up to St. Louis, Haley, who's a very smart and very weird kid, started talking about the imaginary friend that she had had when she was lost in the wilderness, And she said she was very specific about it. Her name was Alicia. She was 3 years old. She had dark hair that she wore in pigtails and a purple sweatshirt with red sleeves and purple pants and white tennis shoes.
Wow.
And she had a flashlight with her.
Wow.
And she said that she kept her company throughout the entire time that she was lost, and that she guided her down the ravine to where the Buffalo River is at the bottom of the valley. The reason why they never found her is because the official search people had not imagined that she would ever try to get down the bluff into the valley, that the only way she could have gotten off of it was by falling off of it, basically. And they never found her. And so she told this story, which totally spooked all the adults. And there's this interesting thing that there's a thing called third man factor, or third man syndrome, uh-huh. which is that sometimes it's been reported by multiple people that someone who is undergoing a long and physically strenuous and traumatic ordeal from which they are not at all sure that they will survive. People who have made it out have reported this feeling that there was a conscious second entity, like with them, like the feeling of the presence of another person.
Huh.
And this was most famously reported by Ernest Shackleton, who at some point during one of his treks back from Antarctica, they were crossing St. George Island, really big island in Antarctica, and it was like just two guys. They were the last two people who were alive from the expedition, and they were starving and snowblind and exhausted and just like near death. They made it, but they both reported this feeling that there was a third person with them. They kept on looking back over their shoulders and kind of hallucinating that there was a third person with them, which inspired the lines in T.S. Eliot's The Wasteland that goes, "Who is that third who walks always beside you?"
Interesting.
Yeah. And
it almost sounds like a divine presence.
Yeah. Well, the mountain climber Reinhold Messner has also reported at some point feeling a second presence with him when he was in, you know, a similar ordeal.
Mortal danger,
right. Mm-hmm. And so she told this story about her imaginary friend. It really spooked all the adults around her, and they all started, you know, chattering about it. And then when Haley was lost, there was this guy named Tim Ernst, who's a nature photographer who lived in that area. And when she was lost, that guy offered to put her parents and her grandparents and several other friends up in his house. And that guy's house kind of became one of the main hubs of the search effort. And that guy also became a very fast friend of the family after that ordeal. And Tim had lived in that area for a really long time, and he remembered something that had happened in 1978. He didn't recall it very well, but he mentioned it to my Aunt Joyce. And Joyce, of all the people involved in the story, was like the most distraught of anyone.
I bet, yeah.
Because not only was she also terrified that Haley might be dead, but she also had the weight of feeling like it was her fault.
Oh yeah.
And her daughter Kelly has told me that at no point was anyone ever mad at Joyce. Like, everyone knew that it could have happened to anyone. No one was mad, but she still was just crushed by the guilt.
Okay.
And she started doing research into this really interesting thing that happened in that exact same spot, within a mile of where Haley got lost in the Buffalo National River Wilderness in Newton County, Arkansas, where on April 28th, I believe, 1978, there was the game warden of Newton County was out in that exact same wilderness hunting turkeys with a hunting buddy of his, and they came across a group of people that were camped out in the woods in a really remote place. And as one of the retired sheriff's deputies who I talked to in Arkansas back in December, who was one of the arresting officers, as he put it, The game warden just thought they were acting kind of funny. And they that guy, the game warden, wrote down the license plate numbers of the camper trailer that they were camping in. And then he and his friend hiked back to the road, and they found another car parked there that they guessed correctly they had driven in also. And they wrote down that plate number, too. And then he hiked back to his, like, official game warden vehicle that has a radio in it. And he radioed the Newton County Sheriff and asked him to run the plate numbers, and he did. And he came back with an active arrest warrant on suspicion of child abuse in Benton County.
Ooh.
This
is 1978.
This is 78,
so
yeah.
So we'll go on. Okay.
And then the sheriff's deputies met up with the sheriff. It was so early in the morning, he hadn't come to work yet. And they got him at his house, and they all met up on the road. And then the three sheriff's deputies, the sheriff, the game warden, and the game warden's hunting buddy, who was just happened to be there,
sure,
all went in and arrested them. And most of them came pretty – it was two adult men in his 50s and one in his 30s, and a teenage boy, and two women, one in her 30s and one in her early 20s. And the teenage boy – refused. Everyone else allowed themselves to be arrested peacefully and came quietly, but the teenage boy refused to come out of the camper trailer. And the guy that I talked to, Ray Watkins, who was the sheriff's deputy at the time, remembered, you know, pointing the gun at the trailer and saying, "If you don't come out of there, I'm going to start shooting." And he eventually came out, and they arrested all of them. And they were supposed to have a 3-year-old girl with them. That's what the police in Benton County told them,
but
she wasn't there. And while they were all sitting in the back of the cruisers, getting ready to, you know, be taken to jail, the sheriff was poking around their campsite and uncovered a spot that looked like something had been buried. And so he started digging found the body of the 3-year-old girl, which had been shot 8 times with a .22. And then stuffed in a plastic bag, which was then stuffed in a plastic paint bucket and buried about 2 feet deep in the woods.
Oh, that's horrifying.
Yeah. And they were all arrested for – they had already been arrested, but they were charged with murder.
Yeah.
And it was a cult. It was a very small cult of about 12 adults. I'm keeping an eye on the time.
Oh, that's fine. Riveted.
It was about 12 adults and a handful of kids, like 5 kids or something like that. And it had started in 1972 in the Florida Panhandle, where there was this guy, and here's the point where I can't use any of these people's names because I haven't come to agreement.
Well, that's fine. So it was a 3-year-old girl.
It was a guy and his wife, who's a Methodist minister, weirdly, who became convinced somehow that their 12-year-old son at the time was a prophet. And they kind of organized this small cult, like kind of Christian sort of doomsday cult around this kid being a prophet. And they moved around several times in the South. They went from Florida to Baton Rouge, where they picked up a few new members. And then they moved to Rogers, Arkansas for some reason. And for a while, the whole cult was living in two trailers that were next to each other in a trailer park in Rogers, and another apartment nearby. And at some point, one of the women in the cult was declared by the interpreter. They had the prophet and the interpreter, and those were the two kind of leaders of the cult. And the interpreter told her that she was anathema and that she had to be cast out of the light of God, and she had to leave. But they kept her 2 kids.
Whoa.
And that woman, who was from Baton Rouge, drove all the way from Rogers back to Baton Rouge, then had second thoughts, turned around, drove all the way back to Rogers, and set up a meeting with a family law lawyer to try to get her 2 kids back.
Right.
And she went and met with this lawyer in Rogers and explained the situation, and that lawyer was basically like, lady, this is not a hire a lawyer problem you have here. This is a call the cops problem. And so that lawyer, I think, called up the Rogers police and said, I don't know what's going on, but something deeply crazy and disturbing and involving young children is going on in that trailer park, and you guys should check it out. And before they had the arrest warrant, there was a cop who drove by the two trailers just to kind of see if he could see anything, and he wrote down the plate numbers of the cars that were parked there. And then later that day, when they had the warrant, a bunch more cops came to arrest them. And when they got there, the two trailers were on fire and everyone had fled. And they had, half of the cult went to Missouri to try to kidnap the kids of another member of the cult and bring them to where the others were camped in the Buffalo River Wilderness on top of Cave Mountain. And they had been camped there for a few days, and at some point the prophet had, the teenage kid, he was 17 at the time, mm-hmm. leading the cult, had declared the 3-year-old girl to be anathema. And they, not he, but a couple of other people on his orders, shot her and buried her, and the next day was when the game warden happened to come across their campsite.
Wow.
And
1978.
That was I believe April 28th, 1978, a Tuesday.
And what happened
was there were 5 people arrested. The guy,
the girl though.
Yeah.
The 3-year-old girl.
Right. So
what was she wearing?
Oh, I don't know.
Was she wearing?
One of the things that I'm going to research if I do get this book proposal sold is stuff like that. But I don't actually know. Although I'm sure that information is out there somewhere. You know, that it's probably in a police report back from 78.
Uh-huh.
You know, although it's a little difficult to find police reports about stuff like this because. This happened in a really rural county where police work and everything else was on a very kind of like wink and handshake basis.
They
didn't keep a lot of records, you know. But the thing is that the father and his son, the prophet, the 17-year-old kid, and his stepson, who is the other guy that was with them. They all eventually pled guilty to or nolo contendere to murder charges, and contendere, pardon me, and they were all sentenced. The father and his son were sentenced to life sentences, and the other guy got a 50-year sentence plus another 15 for illegal possession of a firearm. Oh, and by the way, when the cops finally entered the camper trailer that day, they found it just, they were armed to the hilt. They had about 30 firearms and many, many cases of ammunition with them. And also, like, boxes of MREs and things like
God.
That. Just they were awaiting the end of the world.
Yeah, well, that's...
They were convinced there this thing that was about to happen, called the Tribulation, which they believed that there was a nuclear war that was going to commence in any second, after which would be a 3.5-year period of the chaotic collapse of human civilization, and at the end of that would be the second coming of Christ. That's what they were getting ready for.
Yeah, and that involved murdering a 3-year-old girl.
Right.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Those 3 guys got near life sentences in one case and life sentences in the case of the other two.
But what about the girl?
Well, the girl, she was dead. That's the end of her story.
No, but being like...
Yeah.
That, well, the connection.
Of course, yeah. So basically, wait, I should say this because it's an important thing and I'm running out of time, although I'm looking at it. I got my eye on it.
No, that's all right.
Know, which is that that basically the mother of the girl was also, her case was the only case that went to trial because she was the only one arrested who didn't, who maintained her plea of not guilty. And one of the other people that was with them, the woman in her 30s, was the interpreter, one of the leaders of the cult. And the prosecutor offered her immunity in exchange for her testifying against the mother. And the mother was 22 years old at the time.
Oh, yeah.
And you know, and her story was basically like she was from Baton Rouge. And she, you know, was married her high school sweetheart at the age of 18, who immediately started beating her and then deserted her after their daughter was born. And that's when she went to an employment office where she met several members of this cult because they were working there, probably because an employment office is a good place to meet desperate people. You know, and she was in an incredibly emotionally vulnerable state, and she was dead broke and had a kid, and she joined the cult. She kind of, at that point, kind of fit the perfect profile for the kind of person that cults prey on.
Right.
You know, one of her lawyers, her defense lawyer, a team out of a team of two, later became a judge, and that guy, who's also dead now, just happened to be a friend of Jane Joyce's. And
whoa.
Yeah, and they knew him, and they and Joyce found out that he had been the one of the defending attorneys in her trial back in 1978, and she went and asked him about it, and he said that there were, of all the cases he was ever involved in, that was the one that about which he had the deepest regrets. He said it really, really haunted him, because she was found guilty and sentenced to 5 years, of which she served three, but he believed that she was just as much a victim as her daughter had been, and that she shouldn't have served any jail time at all. Mm. And he was incensed that they offered this other woman, who was basically one of the leaders of the cult, immunity from prosecution in order to testify against her. Mm. And he said that the other lawyer that he was working with, he used to be friends with the guy, but there was a rift between them, and they never spoke again after that. And basically, the reason was that the other lawyer thought that the 5-year sentence she got was an acceptable compromise, and he didn't. And then they never spoke again after that.
Wow.
Tom, the lawyer, come judge. He had kept in touch with the mother all these years, and he gave Joyce her email. And Joyce emailed her, and they've been kind of pen pals, correspondents, for the past 15 years.
What?
Yeah.
Wow.
They write to each other a lot.
Wild.
Yeah.
Wild story.
And basically, you know, I do not believe that that her daughter, who was murdered in the exact same area of the woods, it was like the ghost or spirit or whatever that guided Haley through her ordeal. But that woman, her mother, who, by the way, like the only person in her whole sort of regular social orbit who knows anything about her past, is her husband. He knows, but no one else does. Mm-hmm. All of her, you know, friends, neighbors, right, coworkers, right, right. Her husband's entire, the rest of his family, none of them know. It's something that she's kept deeply under wraps for her life ever since then. She still lives on the family farm in Baton Rouge that she grew up in, or near Baton Rouge, and she believes that it was the ghost of her, or spirit or something, of her daughter that accompanied Haley. And the kind of interesting thing about it, at least to me, is that in a sense, like Joyce, that woman has been racked with guilt for the past 40 some years, and she's had to deal with it completely alone, because she doesn't tell anybody about it. And she said it in an email to Joyce. She said something like, that it was the first thing that had happened. This, Joyce getting in touch with her and telling her the whole story about Haley. The first thing that had happened that kind of made her think that in some way that daughter had not led a completely meaningless short life. She said if she had to die in order to save Haley, and Haley had to live in order to save me in some sort of way.
Well, you know what? That's a great ending to a really depressing, wild Halloween tale.
It did happen in the springtime.
Wow. Yeah. Wow. I look forward to reading it when it comes out, actually.
Yeah.
All the different pieces, how they all fit together. And
There's many more twists and turns in the story also. I gave that, what I just gave you and our listeners, is the elevator version.
That was the elevator version.
Yeah.
That's a long elevator ride. Well, so... well, thanks so much for sharing that, Ben.
I'll get the
magazine, and I'll get the book when it comes out. So I think we got a little bit of time, and I'm just gonna play one of my favorite songs about a rabbit. This has been Foraging Ahead. I'm Kevin Factor with
Benjamin Hale. Thank you for having me.
Mr. Rabbit, your coat is mighty gray. Yes, bless God has made that way. Every little soul must shine. Every little soul must shine.
a mighty long.